Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. It's World Philosophy Day. You may or may not have known, in honor of World Philosophy Day, USU philosophy professors are inviting you to ask us anything. This event is at the Logan Library today at 5 p.m. Everyone is invited. The panel will consist of USU professors Charlie Heeneman, Harrison Kleiner, Rachel Robinson Green, Brittany Gentry, Michael Otteson, and Alex Barrientos. And after a short introduction, questions will be taken from the audience. The event will be moderated by Professor Mike Ashfield. Free coffee and refreshments are provided. That, again, is Logan Library, 5 p.m. today. Ask the professors anything. Today, we'll be talking with USU philosophy faculty members Mike Ashfield, Rachel Robinson Green, and Michael Otteson. So, Mike Ashfield, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Tom.
Rachel Robinson Green, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Michael Otteson, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
So I just want to, first of all, of course, many of our listeners will not conveniently be able to go to the Logan Library. We broadcast statewide and really worldwide at upr.org. So I want to provide this opportunity for you. Of course, if you're in the Cache Valley area, certainly come do the face-to-face with the professors. Logan Library, 5 p.m. today. It sounds like a lot of fun. If you're not going to be in the area, use this program as an opportunity. If you want to ask a philosophy professor anything, a couple of ways you can get to us, 800-826-1495. 800-826-1495 is the phone number. Or you can email us to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Let me start with Mike Ashfield. I understand you're the organizer of the event. What gave you this idea? Have you been participating in something similar before?
I have not. Last year, we organized a fundraiser, the three of us actually, Dr. Robinson Green, Dr. Otteson, and I, together with the Philosophy Club and the USU Effective Altruism Club. We put together a fundraiser and sponsored it through our ethics classes, where students can get extra credit for participating. And as it happened, it just kind of fell on World Philosophy Day as a happy coincidence. And I think that's what put it on my radar, actually. I hadn't even heard of it until then. So, but then this year I thought, well, let's put a little more thought into what we're going to do. And we have been making, we have sort of a long-term priority to sort of grow into a more public-facing program. We think that's a natural extension of USU's access mission as a land-grant university. And this just seems like a nice way to do it and build some connections in the community.
So. Yeah. Does sound fun. I want to follow up. Did I hear you right? The Altruism Club, Effective Altruism Club? What is that?
Yeah. Well, out of the three of us, I might not be the most qualified to tell you about Effective Altruism, but it is really a movement that has grown out of the work of living philosophers who have argued that that we can and should give effectively to charitable organizations, probably more than most of us usually assume that we owe. And so there's sort of a whole movement and infrastructure that's been built around identifying really effective relief work that's being done around the world, where you have a sort of really good conversion from donations of money in to lives saved out on the other end, and similar sorts of improvements in quality of life, and so it's really grown very quickly in the last few years. There are, you know, books and you know, websites devoted to this movement, and there's a local chapter here on campus. So the Philosophy Club to team up with them.
So Professor Robinson Green or Professor Otteson, anything you want to add on that?
Sure. Yeah. Effective altruism is, I echo everything that Professor Ashfield just said, but it's about rethinking what it means to live a successful life. I think I remember when I was in college, a lot of people thought of success as a matter of buying a house, having the nicest car, keeping up with the Joneses, when effective altruism encourages us to think about living a successful life in terms of how much good we can do for others and living in a way that we can best benefit other people.
Yeah. All right. Great. Well, let me go around the panel to just kind of get to know you all. So starting with Mike Ashfield again, How did you get into philosophy? I'm reading on your bio. You started out with a at a divinity college.
That's right. So I'm Canadian. I grew up in New Brunswick on the east coast of Canada, and I did an undergraduate degree in sort of the history of philosophy at St. Thomas University, which is a small liberal arts college. From there, I considered a call to ministry and went to attended Acadia Divinity College, which is a seminary in Nova Scotia, Canada. I enjoyed my time there, but I pretty quickly realized that I wasn't cut out for the ministry, that I was really more interested in sort of the thinking aspect of theology. There was a philosophy professor there who actually made a profound kind of impact on me. His name is Dr. Steve Mateson. He's still teaching philosophy at Acadia. And he kind of he's a very strident atheist, which was a funny sort of thing for me as a divinity student. But we just had a kind of natural affinity, and he, sort of he was very supportive. So he encouraged me to consider graduate work in philosophy, and that's what sort of set me on the path towards. I did a master's outside of Chicago at Northern Illinois University, and then I was very grateful to attend University of Southern California to do my PhD.
All right. Rachel Robinson Green, tell me how you got into philosophy. How did you choose this field?
Well, I initially started college thinking I was going to be a lawyer. And but then I just took my first philosophy class and fell in love, and that was it.
What was it about that class? Do you remember?
I think it's the kind of questions that philosophy poses. They're fundamental human questions. I think at our department here at USU, we really emphasize public philosophy, engaging with the community. And one reason that I think that philosophers engaging with the communities is so important is because the questions philosophy poses are human questions that are interesting to all of us. Questions about the nature of personal identity or free will or how we should be oriented to our own death or the death of others, those kinds of questions are important.
I want to follow up. So public facing philosophy, I guess, one stereotype of philosophers is navel gazing, right? That's questions, self-indulgent questions leading to nowhere. That horrible stereotyping. rebut that if you would. And I guess the public facing philosophy is we come together to try to solve problems.
Yeah, I just don't think that that stereotype could be further from the truth. I mean, all of our institutions are grounded in deep philosophical questions. So, for example, the extent to which we have free will has implications for all sorts of questions about what people deserve, right? So, questions about incarceration, questions about grades, questions about when anger is warranted, those types of things. Questions about personal identity impact, how we might think about things like dementia. And then, of course, questions of ethics are critically important and critical for best practices when it comes to reasoning, what it means to know something.
I want to return
And
to
especially in
ethics.
today's climate, where information literacy is so important with the internet and the rise of AI, the skills that philosophy provides are just, it's impossible to overstate their importance.
I want to return to a couple of those things as we go along. Let me bring in Professor Michael Otteson. Same question to you. How did you get into this field?
I've actually I attended Utah State University. I'm from Utah, and when I sort of got to college, there was a sort of group of people that I knew that were intensely interested in sort of theological and philosophical questions. And my first week at Utah State, I went to an event that the USU Philosophy Club put on, and I was hooked for a lot of the reasons that my colleagues have kind of elucidated, where philosophy is sort of the pursuit of the good, the true, and the beautiful, sometimes it's said, right? What is the ultimate nature of reality? Who are we? How should we live our lives? And I've had a hard time thinking about anything else just about since I first became aware of these sorts of questions.
I was going to do this later in the program, but I was talking about some stereotypes, and Professor Robinson Green's been, bursting those. I don't know if any of you are concerned about this. I'll go in the same order here, starting with Mike Ashfield. Have each of you tackled this? You're no doubt aware that there is. I don't know if it's growing. It seems to me to be growing. Segment of the population in the United States that's anti-intellectual, anti-empirical evidence, anti-conventional wisdom, and it seems to me philosophy is intellectual, right? You're kind of right in the middle there. Chew on that a bit, Professor Ashfield, and then I'll have everybody else talk about this.
Sure. So, I mean, I guess I'll start with my experience in my classes. I have rarely encountered that sort of thing, actually, among Utah State students. It exists, of course, but I guess there's some self-selection that happens in our classes. People sort of tend to only join a philosophy class because they're at least a little open to thinking about things. And yet it still happens. There's still people that, they might be generally open, but on certain questions, they just want to say, like, I already know the answer to that, and I'm not really interested in sort of pursuing it further. But I think one thing that happens in a philosophy class that's kind of special is that, students and professors and students among one another develop a rapport, develop some trust in one another. Our classes are generally small. We cap them at no larger than 40 to try to keep discussion possible as a group. And we make a pretty deliberate effort to foster a kind of a trust and considerateness for one another, respect. And so I've rarely seen a semester go by where those who are shy, those who are closed off, those who are even overtly sort of trying to shut down certain discussions, don't over time come to see the value of opening inquiry about those questions and sort of asking, yeah, maybe there is some relevant evidence here I need to consider. So I think in a way that's sort of the magic of studying philosophy is that some people who've never really been invited to consider certain sorts of questions get invited to do so. And they're not sort of automatically required to take a certain line on the answer to that question, right? So it can be quite freeing, and I think it surprises people that they find that experience so liberating.
Mm. Richard Robinson Green, I guess the same question. There's I don't know, maybe the voices of some of these folks get amplified unduly, but there are I don't know how many people, but it seems like there is a strain of anti-intellectualism in the country.
I think there are different motivations for anti-intellectualism, so I think we can't paint them all with one brush. But I think that academia in general could do a much better job with integrating the community into conversations. And I think if we did that, I mean, I think maybe if there are these strains of anti-intellectualism, it's because we've crafted these in-group, out-groups, and resentment gets built on the basis of feeling like you're not in the in-group or something like that. As I've said before, philosophical conversations are really for everyone, and they have a humanizing effect. And so you might be resentful of something if you feel disenfranchised and treated like you're not part of it. I'll give you an example of a powerful experience I've had on more than one occasion. My husband and I do ethics bowls in the Utah State Prison. And some of the students that we work with, they're just wonderful students, but they haven't been treated for a long time like their thoughts matter, right? They feel dehumanized. And so the power of having conversations with a wide range of people and engaging with them and treating them as if their ideas matter because they do, is really powerful. And I wish we could do that with a wider segment of the population because that might do something about the anti-intellectualism.
Yeah. Well, I guess this event, this helps, right? This sort of thing.
Right.
I'll just announce this again. The Honor of World Philosophy Day. There's an event at the Logan Library today at 5 p.m. USU philosophy professors are inviting you to ask them anything. And we're talking with three of those USU philosophy faculty members, Mike Ashfield, Rachel Robison Green, and Michael Otteson. Michael Otteson, have you take a crack at this? How do we approach this problem? I guess you'd probably say it that way, of anti-intellectualism. I guess engagement, how to engage better.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. And I think in your initial formulation of it, you said something about how some people are anti-empirical evidence and anti-conventional wisdom. And so there's lots of different things, I think, kind of going on. And I'll echo my colleague's sort of previous statements that I think that there's multiple sources of anti-intellectualism. But one thing that I sometimes think about is that I don't know how many people wake up in the morning every day and they think, "Oh, I'm an anti-intellectual, right? I don't think that the human mind is capable of sort of like observing reality." And so the question I think, why do I think people perhaps sometimes fall into anti-intellectualism? Well, it should be noted that like the discipline of philosophy, the sort of manifesto of it in the sort of like Greek tradition, is a defense speech in a trial where someone is essentially being executed for practicing philosophy. And so the sort of tension, I think, between certain intellectual endeavors and philosophy and politics is a rich one and has been going on for a long time because sometimes asking big questions might involve undermining deeply held and cherished beliefs that people think are dangerous to question. And given the nature of the activity, I think there's long been, some people are threatened by these sorts of questions, just intrinsically. And that's sort of been, I think, a long running sort of tension in the history of philosophy.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll start with an email question for the panel. We're inviting you to ask our panel anything. By the way, before we go to break, Mike Ashfield, do you get nervous at this? Anything. You can ask anything. I guess philosopher, you're ready for that.
Well, we'll see how it goes. We did want to point out that ask us anything does not entail we will answer absolutely anything. One of my colleagues actually went through and did the proof the other day to show that that is the case. So
Very good. Very good. Yeah. You don't have to answer everything. You'll respond the best you can. Very good. So in honor of World Philosophy Day, USU philosophy professors are inviting you to ask us anything. That event is at the Logan Library today, 5 p.m. And we're talking with three of those panelists, USU philosophy faculty members, Mike Ashfield, Rachel Robison Green, and Michael Otteson. And you're invited to ask our panel here anything. Those who maybe in southern Utah or other areas can't conveniently come to the Logan Library this afternoon, you're invited to participate here. And you can get a question by email to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or call 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. We'll take a brief break, and we'll be back following this. The Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I'm talking with USU philosophy faculty members Mike Ashfield, Rachel Robison-Green, and Michael Otteson. They'll be participating along with several of their colleagues in an event this afternoon at the Logan Library. It's 5 p.m. Today at the Logan Library, and it's in honor of World Philosophy Day. The philosophy professors are inviting you to ask us anything. Should be an interesting event. Free coffee and refreshments provided. And you are invited. You are invited to join this program, especially if you can't make the Logan Library event. Take advantage of this forum to reach us at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com by email, or call us to 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. So we received this email from Mon Gregory in Southern Utah. He says, thanks for celebrating World Philosophy Day with this wonderful panel discussion. This month is also the 50th anniversary of the Institute for the Advancement of Philosophy for Children at Montclair State University in New Jersey, which I have directed for the past several years. Philosophers all over the world today engage young people, preschool through high school, in original inquiry into ethical, aesthetic, political, logical, metaphysical, and other philosophical dimensions of their own experiences. I wonder if your panel members have practiced philosophy with children, or what they think about children's need to do philosophy, and philosophy's need to engage children's ideas. That's Dr. Mon Gregory. He's Professor of Educational Foundations, Montclair State University, Director of Institute for the Advancement of Philosophy for Children. Panel, I don't know who wants to tackle that one first.
I'll take a crack at it.
Okay.
Lovely to hear from you. That's just wonderful. Yes, I did philosophy for children for years in the Weber School District. My husband and I worked with first, second, and third graders. And what we would do is we engaged in the program using Tom Wartenberg's guide. So we did philosophy for children through children's literature. And oh my goodness, children are maybe even better philosophers than adults. You just would not believe what they come up with. So we would read them a children's book, and then we would raise some philosophical questions and they would provide answers. We had them make a little book of their own where they wrote their philosophical ideas and drew illustrations, and it was remarkable. They were just fantastic. I would bring my undergraduates in to help guide it.
No, that's wonderful. Yeah, I could see children, they naturally ask questions, right? That's just what they do. Yeah. Mike Ashfield, do you want to come on this? Professor Gregory have you practiced philosophy with children, or what do you think about children's need to do philosophy, and philosophy's need to engage children's ideas?
Yeah, I'll take the first question first. I haven't practiced philosophy with young children, but I have participated in a program that works with teens to engage them in philosophical discussion. So going back to the reference Dr. Otteson was making to Plato's manifesto about philosophy, in the Apology, where Socrates gives his defense of philosophy, he is defending himself against the charge that he was corrupting the youth. This turned out to be, it seems to have been something of a trumped up charge, politically motivated, because of he had some affiliation with a political faction that was out of favor in Athens. So, people litigate whether or not it was a fair charge, but there is a group here in the United States that has taken this charge, Corrupt the Youth, and facetiously given itself the name of Corrupt the Youth. But what they do is they sort of start chapters in high schools, universities. When I was doing my PhD at USC, a couple of my fellow grad students started a chapter that went into the Hollywood LGBTQ center, where a lot of homeless youth would come in through the day to have a safe place to stay. And so grad students and I believe on occasion undergrads would accompany us, and we would go and lead an afternoon of philosophical discussion about all kinds of different things. And the discussions never failed to be really eye-opening to us as grad students and philosophy majors. I think getting, outside of the kind of the four walls of the university classroom is a really good experience for philosophy teachers because you realize that engaging sort of the people who are the roughly the same age, roughly the same sort of point in life all the time, it gets kind of routine for us, which is not bad. It makes us, better university teachers. But if you want to be a better philosopher, I think you need to push yourself to engage with people in from lots of walks of life. And so I see the value as being two-way. It's good for people from all walks of life to be engaged, and it's good for philosophy professors to push themselves to do so.
Michael Edison, have you take a crack at this philosophy for children?
Yeah, I've not done a ton of work with the sort of program centered on philosophy for children. Though I think that there's really something to that when you Aristotle said philosophy begins in wonder, and thus, I think there's something childlike about the curiosity inherent in philosophy, and I think I'm also remembering a C.S. Lewis reference to the fact that, usually when we describe child, sometimes people think of childish as negative, and usually he thinks that's not really about qualities that children have, it's about qualities they don't have. And there's nothing, and it is precisely that distinction that matters when thinking about there's all sorts of, all the qualities that children have that are in fact, good and wonderful, and one of those is a kind of curiosity that I think is sort of, well situated within the practice of philosophy.
We have a caller on the line. Let's see. Our panelists won't be able to hear this, but I'll relay the question. Jennifer, go ahead.
Can you hear me? Because I'm in a weird, I'm
Yeah,
in a
yes, I
concrete.
can hear you. And just one moment. Let me configure this so our panelists hopefully be able to hear this.
Okay.
Okay, apologize for that. We have our guests on Zoom. What I do is put a pair of headphones on the top of the monitor. So it's high tech here at Utah Public Radio.
Very well checked.
I'm hoping, so panelists, are you able to hear Jennifer at all?
Can you hear me? Can they hear me?
Okay, they're hearing you. Okay, go ahead, Jennifer.
Okay, good. Well, I only caught a smidgen of the discussion over the last several minutes, but I know that we're talking about introducing kids to philosophy. And when I was a kid, I had a baby book, but it went not just, from babyhood to what, high school graduation, but it was called All Her Life, okay? And someone saved that book. I don't know how, but it was salvaged. But anyway, there was a thing where you were supposed to write my your parents filled in the stuff when you were little, and then as you got older, you filled in some things yourself. And one of the things on there was my philosophy of life. And when I was 12, I wrote in there, leave the world in better shape than you found it in, and maybe that's because my parents were members of the they were conflicted people. They met at Stanford, and they were very conflicted people because we ended up I ended up being raised around Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan and all this stuff. But they were also members of the Sierra Club, so go figure. But anyway, the real question that's been bothering me regarding philosophy is this guy at Stanford, Sapolsky, Robert Sapolsky. You familiar with him? You know who this guy is, right?
They're on Zoom. They're
Yes.
nodding their heads. Yes.
Recently wrote something impactful on free will.
And there was a book, and I can't pronounce the guy's last name, but it was called Discovering Free Will and Personal Responsibility. And I don't know what it both might have gone up in fire. But anyway, Then you know that Sapolsky says we have no free will, and that all of our decisions are made. I don't know, but I think he's kind of trying to say they're made biologically. But I have a really hard time with that, because if we don't have free will, then it's kind of like, well, what's the point? You know what I'm saying? And I'm wondering if you guys had, and let me just tell Tom Williams something real quick. I tried to send an email in response to, we had a thing about the election, and I had a hard time with this election. But anyway, and I was frustrated and stuff, and I tried to send an email, and then he had a subsequent repeat of a show about writing, and they touched on writing actual letters. And when my phone wouldn't cooperate and I couldn't send the email, I decided I'm actually gonna sit down and write a letter in response to the conflict resolution guy who was on the other day. But anyway.
Oh, great. I'll look forward to that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna send you a letter, a real live letter in an envelope.
Okay.
And so crazy. But anyway, so do you ever have difficulty with Sapolsky's argument that we don't have free will, and if we don't have free will, how can we have any kind of, I know our justice system is seriously flawed, but if there's no free will, how could you possibly hold people I don't see how you hold people accountable for anything if they don't actually have a choice. You see what I'm saying?
Okay.
And if you've been frustrated with this idea also.
Okay. Well, we'll throw that to panel. Jennifer, thanks so much for that call. Thank you for that question.
Thank you. Okay. All right.
All right. Thank you. I'll look forward to that letter as well. So who would like to tackle that question first?
Well, Dr. Robison Green has taught an entire course on free will, so I feel I should defer to her.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if I want to take a side here on the question of whether we in fact have free will, but I do think that there's some philosophers out there, Greg Caruso, Dirk Paraboom, who make the argument that if we don't have free will, what that actually motivates is compassion, right? And I think that that's really important. If we don't have free will, then it's probably the case that anger is almost never justified. If we don't have free will, then vengeance and our over-reliance on retribution are unwarranted. And so there could actually be some fairly positive consequences of recognizing that we don't have free will. We might actually treat one another better.
Mm. What about this question of accountability that Jennifer brought up? If we don't have free will, how can we be held accountable for our actions, I guess?
Well, we might have to be more nuanced in how we're thinking about accountability. We might, the kinds of punishments that we might participate in might have different fundamental motivations. So instead of a retributivist or a giving someone what they deserve kind of motivation, we might have a motivation like incapacitation or rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm guessing that, as philosophers do, my colleagues probably disagree with me on that, a lot of that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So Professor Ashfield or Professor Allison, like to chime in?
I'll just say first that the eulogy has been given for free will many times in the history of philosophy, only for it to for its death to have been overreported. So. Exaggerated. So I will say that there are still pretty strident and convinced defenders of the existence of free will. I don't count myself among them, but I think they're really brilliant philosophers who think that there's something to this idea, and they're not persuaded by the arguments of the professor mentioned earlier in the question. I guess one thing that I would recommend to listeners is that they might consider looking up a very readable and influential paper from sort of mid-century, 20th century philosophy. A guy named Peter Strawson wrote a paper called Freedom and Resentment. And you can find that for free, lots of places on the internet. And basically, Dr. Strassen argued that our practices of holding people responsible would still make sense even if we don't have free will. He thinks that a lot of the sort of moral emotions that go into our practices of holding one another responsible, if we reflect on them as they are, sort of common sense reflection, I suppose, we find that they can still make a lot of sense. Even if we don't have sort of the most metaphysically satisfying kind of free will that people sometimes think they have. So I think I would just recommend that people read that, and I'd be happy to take their emails if they want to follow up and discuss it afterwards.
All right, great. Professor Robinson, anything you'd like to say about this?
First off, I'll say I've not read Sapolsky's book. I've listened to a few podcasts with him, and it's my understanding as a background that he's something of a primatologist is and so I think a lot of his sort of views on free will are sort of motivated by that. And I guess as a philosopher, when I've listened to him speak, and I not in any sort of systematic way where I've actually seen the sort of I what he believes and why he believes on a written material in front of me, I would say that in philosophy there's even a debate about the definition of free will. And so there's a sense in which it's important to even like clarify our terms in the first place, right? And so this is part of the debate itself, right? There are people, so like Sapolsky is clearly a hard determinist. That's the language we'd use that for that in philosophy, which is just the idea that all of your actions are determined by some combination of environment and genetics. And there's nothing really else to say about that. There are, in a tribute note, there are lots of philosophers. This may even be a plurality view in philosophy. Not to say that that's definitive. I'm just saying that there's plenty of philosophers who believe that all of your actions are determined by environmental and genetic inputs, and also believe that you still have free will. And so, this is in part, I think, it's important to think about this precisely because of questions of accountability, right? Because we might worry that if we just totally denied free will in any sense, that might render a lot of other important sort of ways that we think about human behavior incomprehensible. And so I'm not saying that's necessarily the case, but it's certainly something philosophers argue and debate about. And it's a debate that admits of lots of layers, I suppose, of sort of complexity and disagreement.
All right. Well, great. Thanks for that question, Jennifer. Provoked an interesting discussion there. We have a couple of emails. We'll get to those after a break. Want to make sure we get another break in here. We're talking with USU philosophy faculty members Mike Ashfield, Rachel Robison Green, and Michael Otteson. They, along with several different colleagues, will be participating in an interesting event, Logan Library, today, 5 p.m. You can ask them anything. It's celebrating World Philosophy Day. There'll be free coffee and refreshments there, and invite you to go and interact with USU philosophy professors there at the USU or the Logan Library, 5 p.m. Today. If you can't make that, we invite you to join us here on Access Utah. A couple ways you can reach us: 800-826-1495 is the phone number, 800-826-1495, or upraxcess@gmail.com, upraxcess@gmail.com. We'll get to a couple of emails following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We are celebrating World Philosophy Day, which is today. And USU philosophy professors are inviting you to ask us anything. That event is at the Logan Library today at 5 p.m. 5 p.m. Logan Library. Panel will consist of USU philosophy professors. Event will be moderated by Professor Mike Ashfield. Free coffee and refreshments provided. And you can join us here on this discussion at 800-826-1495, toll-free. Or really, I guess not toll-free. Everybody has cell phones, so it's we're all charged anyway, but that's a vestige. I'm a very old man, I guess is what I'm saying. And upraxcess@gmail.com is the email. that's essentially toll free, upraxis@gmail.com. So let's get to a couple of these questions. So we got this email from Charlie Heneman, your colleague. He says, the logic class at USU is listening, and we want to know, are all philosophers atheists? So who wants to tackle that one?
That's the answer is no.
Okay. Very simple for Mike Ashfield. No. Do you want to expand on that?
There's no, as far as I know, there's no systematic survey done of like all philosophy professors in the world, but I wouldn't be surprised if before too long we have something like that. We do have something called Phil Surveys, which focuses on the English-speaking world, philosophy professors, graduate students. And it is, I think, a minority position. I can't recall the latest, the latest data on the distribution of theism and non-theism and atheism and whatnot. But I think it's holding strong. It doesn't look like that group is in decline as far as I know. Maybe I wish I could recall the numbers off the top of my head. Maybe someone else can look them up while I'm chatting. But, so I myself entered philosophy as a theist. And over time, as I considered the questions that were most important to me, I did have the experience of losing my faith. So I'm not an atheist. You know, I haven't been convinced that I ought to positively disbelieve in the existence of God. I try to keep an open mind. So I suppose I'm a kind of agnostic. I don't think that I know at this point whether there is a God or not. But it's one of the great privileges that I've had is to teach philosophy of religion here at Utah State. That class pretty much always fills every time we offer it. We always get a really engaged, excited group of students. It's regularly one of my favorite classes to teach. And it helps keep the questions fresh for me. So I think theism has a place at the table in philosophy.
All right. Yeah. Shout out to Charlie Heneman's logic class at USU. Thanks for listening. We just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to get in this other email. So I'll go directly to that. This is from Luke. He says, how do you develop a philosophical worldview? Can it be done with certainty? How do you develop a philosophical worldview? How can it be done with certainty? Somebody want to tackle that one?
I think most philosophers come away feeling that after the course of their philosophical studies, they know less than they did when they started. So I definitely don't think that it can be known with certainty. But one of the things that's wonderful about philosophy is it encourages us to consider all sorts of perspectives and worldviews. The initial textbook that I had for my intro to philosophy course was a book called The Great Conversation. And that's how I like to think about philosophy, is it's a big, a long extended conversation through space and time. So I think that to the extent that I've established a worldview, for me, it's been about being willing to listen to a wide range of arguments, even arguments that I vehemently disagree with, and try to assess them on their merits. And then you can start to form a worldview with some coherence, even if not certainty.
We just have about a minute left. Michael Otteson, I'll give you the privilege of the last answer here, just open-ended. Anything else you'd like to say on this discussion or on World Philosophy Day or the event, anything?
Yeah, well, thank you for having us. This has been delightful. And I'll just kind of echo what my colleagues have said. And you know, there's you know, so much to philosophy, and yes, it may perhaps starts and ends in wonder because there's always more to learn. That's also why I think we catalog and try to learn from the long history of that discussion, right? People have been doing work on these sorts of questions for a long time. And part of philosophy is also sort of listening to those older insights, and you know, maybe that helps you give you a leg up on developing, you know, philosophical worldviews and whatnot.
All right, we'll leave it there. Much more we could say. but we're out of time. So we've been talking with Mike Ashfield, USU philosophy faculty member. Mike Ashfield, thank you.
Thank you, Tom. This has been really fun.
Thank you. We'll be also talking with Rachel Robison Green. Thank you.
This is wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. And Michael Otteson, also on the USU philosophy faculty. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you. Those three, along with several of their colleagues, including Charlie Hedeman, Harrison Kleiner, Brittany Gentry, and Alex Bardientos, will be at an event. They're honoring World Philosophy Day, which is today, and those philosophy professors are inviting you to ask them anything. That event is the Logan Library today, 5 p.m., and free coffee or refreshments will be provided. Logan Library today, 5 p.m. So thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll go out as we do on Thursdays with Leo T. and Skywatcher. Thank you.
It's Many Cultures, One Sky. As we continue into a late fall with beautiful leaves all around, deer on the move, azure sky streaked with clouds, a warm sun in and out with the breeze, a little bit chilly. Life goes on. And as the world turns and we approach late afternoon and then the purples and blues of dusk take over Great Salt Lake or Fish Lake or the Fremont River, Sulphur Creek or Grand Staff Canyon by Moab, we connect and see Jupiter. It pops out of the clouds in the east with an assortment of other gems. Binoculars will help you see some of the night sky's fainter objects. One of my stellar friends is Draco the Dragon, which is in the northern sky after sunset and is a long, faint arrangement that winds above the Big and Little Dipper, leading up to the head, which is sort of a closed triangle that looks kind of like a head. The head is due north of Dubé, the top right star of the Dipper. Dubé even has its own beer named after her from the local brewer Uinta. Draco is home to the Cat's Eye Nebula, the Tadpole Galaxy, and the Spindle Galaxy, and lets your mind wander and find the tiny jibble-jabbles in between. And heading into deep space, following Europe's Hera asteroid probe, which is heading for Mars after an engine burn, meeting up with our sometimes nearest planet in March, and then heading out to the asteroid belt for a deflection test, it's heading to Didymos and Dimorphos, as the NASA JPL probe did last year. That impacted one of the space rocks and nudged it into a slightly different orbit, knocking those pool balls around out there. And a new documentary coming out is focusing on spacewoman astronaut Eileen Collins. That's what she's called in the new documentary, Spacewoman. Eileen Collins broke through the ceiling to the stars. Now she's launching into some new territory. She and her daughter Bridget Youngs are featured in the documentary Spacewoman. There's an image credit. Spacewoman film, the dictionary defines spacewoman simply as a woman astronaut. Spacewoman tells the story of the United States' first female astronaut to pilot and command a space shuttle mission. As Eileen would probably say, there are many other women before her who have broken into space without titles. The first, Soviet cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova in 1963, Sally Ride, the first American 21 years later, and many others. Sally Ride at some point simply said, "Yes, I can do all the training a male candidate does and make it, so get used to it. And thanks for the kudos about me being a woman, but I am an astronaut. Doesn't matter all that much to me what sex people are. It matters that we can become astronauts." And an article by Paul Sutar, How the Universe Got Its Large Magnetic Fields has remained one of the stickiest outstanding problems in astrophysics. Now researchers have proposed a novel solution, a giant dust battery, operating when the first stars appeared. Magnetic fields are everywhere in the universe. Of course, there is Earth's magnetic field, which keeps us standing on it, which deflects dangerous cosmic radiation, wiggles our compasses, and guides flocks of migrating birds. Continuing with One Sky, Many Cultures, from Susan Seddon-Boulay and Pomegranate Animal Cards, the bull. Now, not just your ordinary bull, mind you, but you have to look at the painting by Miss Boulay to see what kind of mythical bull we're talking about here. Bull cults were ubiquitous in ancient cultures whose devotees worshipped the beast as a supreme deity. But being the naive and, in my view, sometimes stupid humans we are, the supreme being was ritually sacrificed and its remains and blood scattered in the fields to ensure new growth. In ancient Greek, these rituals were associated with Dionysus, the Greek god of vegetation and renewal. The Titans, however, would resurrect the bull, or sometimes a goat would do. The Spanish bullfight is a vestige of the ancient bull sacrifice. The Minotaur had the head of a bull and the body of a man, is also associated with sacrifice and the cycle of renewal. So keep up the bull, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.